What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Well, midnight, the auto workers went on strike. Three plants, a very targeted strike, a plant in Michigan, a plant in Ohio, and a plant in Missouri. And look, you know, Ford and GM have already announced that there will be layoffs. And this is the reason you do a targeted strike in this way. You go after the main plants, and then they end up laying off other people so that they don't have to be on strike, so they can collect unemployment. Makes it a little easier for folks to get through this. And look, nobody wants this. Nobody. Well, none of the workers want this. Evidently, the big three have decided that this is where they're going to dig in. And as Sean Fain, the UAW president, said, this is our generation's defining moment. The money, he says, is there. The cause is righteous, he says. And the world is watching. And he said the UAW is ready to stand up. And this is what... This is what's happened. And you know, this is one of those moments where, as a country, we can make the choice. And I got to tell you, I applaud Joe Biden for taking the position he's taken. But this is a moment where, as a country, we can influence this. There was talk by Stellantis of moving plants. We talked yesterday about Jim Cramer and his spiel about, if I were in charge of all that, I would just move everything to Mexico and screw all those working people. This is a moment for all of us people who buy cars, all of those people who are the customers, you know, the supposedly the ones who they care so much about. This is where we have to weigh in on this. And we have to stand behind these some 150,000 workers who are fighting for dignity, who are fighting for respect, and fighting to change. And look, this is much bigger than just one industry having you know, a labor struggle. This is about changing the course of work in this country. This is about taking on the status quo of the billionaires getting everything they could possibly want and working people getting the short end of the stick. Now, look, you know, I woke up this morning and I started reading the Foxes and, you know, the CNNs, and, you know, everyone's got their hot take headline. And CNN, the reason nobody pays attention to CNN anymore. And look, I would expect, and I expected Fox to, you know, to be very slanted. I expect the right-wing media to be very slanted against the workers and the UAW. But CNN Politics tweeted out one of their stories, and they wrote, President Joe Biden was dealt an economic and political blow Friday as the United Auto Workers went on strike, a development the White House worked to avoid and now places the president in a bind. I'm going, what? You mean the bind? What bind? That he's going to be pro-worker? That he's going to side with collective bargaining rights? I'm confused. What's the bind? I guess the outcome in this is going to be Joe Biden supports working families. See, now that would be a much better. I would be much happier with that headline. And this is the thing. This is the thing that gets me. Because the reality in this country is the corporate control of our media is far and wide. You've got six corporations who control virtually everything we see, hear, and read. And is it any surprise that this is how they frame it? This is putting Joe Biden in a bind. No, it's not. Biden has been very clear. Going to let collective bargaining work its way. Now, he came out, gave a little spiel today, said, look, nobody wants a strike. Nobody wants this to happen. But here's the thing. Here's the punchline. Here's the money shot. Here's the thing you put on your bumper sticker. And this should have been the headline across every newspaper and every news feed. Record profits mean a record contract. See, that's how we should be thinking. This industry, record profits. Do you know who should share in that wealth? Do you know who should share in the wealth that their labor creates? That's right, the workers. And that's what President Biden said. He's like, look, you know, they deserve a fair share. And he's going to, at this moment, step back and let it play out. He said, workers deserve a fair share. The companies have made some significant offers, but I believe it should go further to ensure record corporate profits mean record contracts. And what does that mean? That means what we used to believe in this country. You work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. Now, what I find interesting is I heard, you know, the broadcasts today, you know, Ford saying, you know, if we gave them what they wanted, it put us out of business. You know, they're greedy. I've heard all of it. I've heard it all. Here's the thing. The money's there. There's a lot of money there. Enormous amount of money. You get the CEO of GM, this Mary Barra. Now, Mary makes a tidy little sum of $29 million a year. She makes almost $2.5 million a month. She makes $557,000 a week. She makes over $111,000 a day. So she should not be talking about greed, and she should not be talking about, well, we can't afford it. Now, she says, according to her, she gets paid on how well the company does. Which is true. But so do the workers. Because here's the thing, when the company does poorly, what do Mary Barra and the rest of her CEO suite shills do? What do? They come back with their hand begging for concessions. And we're in this moment right now because all of these workers have given massive concessions over the last 10, 15 years. Enormous concessions. These auto worker jobs used to be the gold standard of employment in this country, not just this country, on the planet. These used to be the working class jobs that people fought over. They never struggled to find workers. Now, after years of stagnant wages, after years of destroying benefits, after years of destroying working conditions, after years of pushing for temp employees, the workers have finally had enough. And are we surprised? No, we're not surprised. But this frame that the corporate-controlled media and the Mary Barras of the world keep pushing us. Well, you know, the CEOs, you know, who make a ton of money, they do well when the company does well. Well, then that should apply to the workers as well. They should do well when the company does well as well. Because like I said, when things go south, where's the first place the Mary Barras of the world come? That's right. They lay people off. They close plants. They move overseas. They do all of these cost-cutting, ending redundancy kind of things, you know, to fatten the bottom line. So what? So they can fatten their paycheck. And look, she's not alone. Jim Farley, the CEO of Ford, in 2021 made over $22 million, a compensation rate of what, 356-1 with his employees. The Stellantis CEO made over $25 million. These people are not hurting, but yet that assembly line worker making 17, 18 bucks an hour, that's too much. There's something wrong here, folks. There's something wrong. And good on the UAW for standing up in this moment and saying, look, we're going to change things. We're going to ensure that workers get a fair shot. Now, you listen to what Biden had to say. Biden said, let me be clear. No one wants a strike. Say it again. No one wants a strike. But I respect the workers' right to use their options in the collective bargaining system. And I understand the workers' frustrations. Biden's supportive. Most pro-union president in my lifetime. Donald Trump, on the other hand, Donald Trump gave his little interview and said he was asked, which side are you on? He goes, well, I just want to make America great. And then sought out to attack the UAW. But I'm neutral, but I'm going to attack them because they didn't endorse him. And in fact, the president, Sean Fain, said, you know, another Trump presidency would be a disaster. Which, you know, Trump then took a problem with. But he went on to say that the auto workers are being sold down the river by the leadership. Now, here's the weird thing. This is the really bizarre thing. Because this leadership right now was the first elected, directly elected, one member, one vote, directly elected by the members. They are literally doing exactly what the members want. Which is why this is... Well, this is going the way it's going because the members aren't going to settle for, well, status quo. Now I've heard, well, you know, the auto industry, they offered a record 20%. Their executives took 40 over the last couple of years. The money is there. It's just a matter of what are your priorities? Is it paying your workers? Is it investing in your people? Is it sharing the wealth that their labor creates? Or is it doing what Stellantis did? We're going to have $500 million in stock buybacks, which if you've listened to this show longer than 15 minutes, you know that I am angry anytime I hear a corporation engaging in stock buybacks because what it says is, you have no productive use for the profits that you're making other than jacking up your share price to enrich your CEOs and your shareholders. That's money that could be invested in new equipment, better training for workers, better wages, better benefits, all kinds of things. But the choice by corporate America, the choice by corporate globe is enrich thyself over their workers. So I got lots to get to today. This is just one of those, you know, good on these workers. We are going to stand with them. We're going to try and get folks to come on the program and tell us what's going on the picket lines. And we'll get to some of that. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the time.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for the last couple of days, we've been talking about this CEO, this Tim Gerner. And, you know, he got himself into a little twist, you know, basically saying that, you know, those workers are lazy. They've gotten used to not doing any work and getting paid more than they're worth. And he said, look, you know, we need mass unemployment. We need to make those people desperate again so they'll go back to work. And, you know, he came out a couple of days later after taking some pretty heavy abuse because, oops, shouldn't have said that out loud. And I'm sure took a verbal lashing from his fellow country club folk. But he did. He came out and he did the mea culpa. You know, I'm sorry. I should have. I have empathy. I have, you know, he tried. He got the crisis management team together. They did something. And I gave him credit for that. I said, call me because I want to hear it in person. But he tried. So today, I see Drew Barrymore. Drew Barrymore released an apology video, which I got to tell you, I could not get all the way through. The first two, it's a 4.5 minute video of her, you know, doing this kind of whiny, kind of woe is poor me. You know, I make the decision, you know. Now, understand. She is choosing to put herself in the middle of all this. She has chosen to resume production of her show while her writers and folks are fighting to get a fair contract. She is undermining their power. And she's going to scab. Understand, this video was not, oh, I'm so sorry, I learned my lesson, I won't scab. No, she's going to continue to scab. She's going to be the scab that she is. But she wants you to know she feels bad, a little weepy. And I like what Bradley Whitford pointed out, because much more eloquent than I am. He said, Drew Barrymore would like you to know that undermining union solidarity at the most crucial moment in Hollywood labor history makes her the victim. This has been like a super tough week for her. And my take on it was, this is a giant F you to working people. Sorry, Drew. You're right. It's not okay to be a scab. Don't be a scab. That was my take. I like Bradley's a little bit better, because she does. She tries to put herself in the victim role. And this is where, as a society, we need to hold people like Drew accountable. Now, look, she's worth, what, $140 million, $120 million, some obscene amount that she could easily take a couple of days off. It's not going to hurt her to miss a couple of days of work. Now, her writers, on the other hand, the people who put the words into her mouth, and look, not an easy job writing for Drew Barrymore, who can't seem to pronounce the letter S. So imagine trying to write monologues for someone who can't say the S sound. Maybe op-agging. Stop scabbing. Writers don't need an apology. They need you to stop. But this is one of these things where, as a society, we need to hold people like this accountable. And I go back to, and I've told this story a number of times before. When I moved in with my grandparents, there was a guy, catty corner from my grandparents' house, that nobody ever visited their house. I never saw anyone go there outside of the core family members. And when I moved in, my grandfather said, "Don't you ever go over there. I will beat you senseless." And I, yeah, okay. Yeah, I was 13. What did I know? Okay, I won't. There's a beating I don't need. About 10 years later, I decided to ask. I go, you know, what was that all about? Because it didn't make any sense to me. The guy had passed, and, you know, it just seemed like the right time. And turns out this person had crossed a railroad picket, you know, like 40 years earlier. And it wasn't just my grandfather who held that against this guy, because you don't scab, especially that generation. You know, they were the ones who fought the bloody battles on the picket lines. These are the people who met the business ends of the billy clubs and the thugs coming out in the night and beating people up. These are the people who fought and bled and died so that you could get the things that we take for granted. So that when someone crossed a picket line, someone was a scab in those days, that was like the scarlet letter. You were marked with that forever. And we need to go back to that. We need to hold the Drew Barrymores, the Bill Maher's. We need to hold the View, the freaking View. And I don't care how you spin it. I don't care how you justify it. I don't care how you rationalize it in your little pea brains. It's harmful. And people need to hold them accountable. I will never watch The View again. I mean, that's it. Or I can't say I'll never watch The Drew Barrymore Show, because I never watched it before because I didn't know it existed. But I do now. And this is one of these moments where I'm again angered. Because as a society, we have to make choices. And this is really one of those which side are you on kind of moments. Are you on the side of the well-to-do and the folks who, well, you know, your little labor strife, that's not our concern. You know, we're above that pettiness. And we need to understand as a society that these people who are walking a picket line, they're not just doing it for themselves. Now, they're doing it for themselves. They want better wages. They want better hours, better conditions. They want better opportunities. Absolutely, without question, that is true. But there's a trickle-down effect here to where as their conditions increase, as their conditions get better, they bring people up with this is that rising tide lifting all boats. You know, when we had a strong unionized auto sector across the board, these jobs paid incredible wages. And everybody that had anything to do with that industry did well too. The trucking industry did incredibly well because the auto industry raised wages. And I think back to my grandfather, who, when he started in his work life, now this is pre-minimum wage, was making $0.17 an hour, shoveling coal off the back of a coal truck. There was no union back then for him. There was no fighting with the boss. You were at will. And if you didn't shovel enough coal fast enough, you were fired. You didn't get the 17 cents for that day. And he cheated you out of wages half the time anyway. And in his lifetime, through his sacrifice, his going on strike every couple of years, his, you know, preparing for that and going out and literally fighting in the streets so that his kids and grandkids could have a better life. It's a remarkable story. And it's a lot of our grandparents' generation. And we're in this situation right now where Sean Fain is right. This is this generation's moment. This is the defining moment of this time. And the cause is righteous. because there's no justification for the auto industry to say, no, sorry, we're broke. They're, because they're not. They've made a couple $100 billion in profits. The question is, how long will this last? And will this get the kind of support that it needs from average, everyday working people, people like you and me? I want to get out to one of the picket lines because this is that moment where we adopt a striker. This is what that moment where we walk in their shoes for a day, where we help keep food on their table to get them through this. Because at the other, on the other side of this, this is the model, this is the mold that moves us all forward. So I got to tell you, I'm hopeful and good on these folks for stepping up, and we'll see where this takes us. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, I want to hear it. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here we go again. School district in southern New Jersey, the Deptford School District. Evidently, they're cracking down. Cracking down on those deadbeat kids. Evidently, the school has some unpaid meal plans, so they're going to do what a good conservative, God-fearing Christian person would do. No, they're not going to feed the children. No, that's not going to happen. No, they're actually, what the plan is because, you know, they have kids who have run up debts, they're now going to either give them, there's a new policy, going to serve them peanut butter or cheese sandwiches. That's what you're going to get for lunch. Sorry, kids, we're not going to let you go hungry, but you're not getting the good stuff or whatever that is. We're going to give you something out of a special line so that we can then humiliate you as well. And look, as someone who remembers vividly, you know, having to go to the free line when I was a kid and get the special lunch, this particularly hits a spot for me, particularly sends me off the deep end, because you don't do this to children. It's not their fault that their parents are struggling. It's not their fault that they were born into poverty. It's not. And stop trying to blame them. This is evil. And what kind of monsters would do this? What kind of horrible human beings would do this? Oh, yeah, I know. Conservatives. Because, again, you know, this week, you know, we saw the Census Bureau numbers just came out. And thank you to all of the Republicans and Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Childhood poverty more than doubled. And, you know, hey, you know, we didn't even offer them cheese sandwiches. Not even the government cheese sandwiches. And this is one of those things that's just infuriating to me. Because, again, I hate sounding like a broken record. I hate going over this and over this and over this. But it bears repeating. We're the wealthiest country in the history of the planet at its wealthiest moment, and we're letting kids go hungry, and we're humiliating them in the process just because their parents can't pay the bill. Now, this is a policy thing. These are policy choices. So let me ask, because I got to know, are you okay with this? Is this something, as a citizen of this country, as a taxpayer in this country, are you okay with the fact that as a matter of choice, we're choosing to have more hungry children? And that a school district who's supposed to be teaching it's just plain evil to me. What kind of monsters would do this? Oh, yeah, I know which kind. the kind that want our kids, you know, these kids, the poor kids, to get back into the workplace. And because if they're hungry, they're going to work harder, right? So that they, you know, if they don't want cheese sandwiches, maybe they're going to want a little bologna on that bread. And so they'll go to work. Now, what's interesting is our friend Jordan Barab over at Confined Spaces, he did a mock-up on, remember the kid, it was in Wisconsin, who got killed at the sawmill. And he kind of mocks this, going, you know, the headline was sawmill where Wisconsin teen died in freak accident, ordered to pay $190,000 fine. It wasn't a freak accident. Sorry, not a freak accident. When you're not taught to turn the machine off, you know, everyone who's worked around dangerous machinery knows lockout, tagout. You know, everyone gets that, because you're supposed to know the procedures of shutting things down so that you don't put yourself into, oh, I don't know, in a position that you get sucked into the machine and killed. And that's where this is. I mean, you know, this kid got pinned in this machine. It took 17 minutes for anyone to realize that he had gotten pinned. And, well, by then, too late. So when I saw the fine, is $190,000, is that what a 16-year-old's life is worth? Now, again, you know, as Jordan points out, it's not the media's fault that this kid got killed. But it is their fault that they minimize this all the time. These headlines, oh, it was a freak accident. No, not a freak accident. This was something that could have been avoided, should have been avoided. We've got rules in place. We've got laws for this. A 16-year-old shouldn't even been doing the job. How come we don't focus enough on that? How come we don't focus enough on what's happening in this country to our children? Again, the people who tell us that they love the children and they want more of them born are doing, well, this kind of stuff. Now, look, I'm not against kids working. You know, my kids have always had some kind of employment, whether it's, you know, me creating something for them or them working in a place where they learn to get to work on time. They learn to be, you know, good, conscientious employees. They learn to have money and what to do with it. You know, we've set up, you know, IRAs for them. You know, we've done all these things over the years to help them learn how to earn, use, and save money. Important lessons. But this idea that we're going to be putting kids back into dangerous jobs, I'm sorry, I'm not there. Because I know our history. I know where we've come from. You know, when we were on our Working Class Heroes radio tour, we went down into a coal mine up in Lackawanna County here in Pennsylvania. And you go down, you know, 300 feet down into the earth, into this dark, damp, horrible environment. And I'll never forget it. This woman was standing behind me. And the guy who was giving the tour was telling us, you know, the conditions. He said, you know, imagine, he turned the lamp down a little bit. He goes, this was the light that was in, that would have been here. You know, and imagine you're a 6-7-year-old kid. You know, your job is to stand by this door. You're a 10-11-year-old kid. Your job is to walk the mules through this knee-deep muck of feces and coal ash and animal excrement and all of this stuff. And this is the condition. And you know, the rocks are sharp and you get cut all the time. And the woman behind me goes, well, where was OSHA? And everyone just kind of stopped and this was pre-OSHA. Way pre-OSHA. This was, if you're desperate enough, hungry enough to work in these deplorable conditions, if you were exploitable enough, that's where you went. And I swear there are people who want to take us back to those days. And when I see stories like these, it infuriates me. Let's go to the phones. I've got Julie on line one from Minnesota. Julie, how are you?
Hi. Hey, how you doing? You know, the last time we had a Republican governor in this state was about 20 years ago. It was Tim Pawlenty. And he messed things up. He got us $6 billion in debt. And I'll tell you something, 20 years ago, $6 billion in debt. That was real money back then.
That was a lot of money.
Yeah. We had Mark Dayton, Democrat, for 8 years. He helped drag us up out of debt. Now, this past year, we had approximately $18 billion to the surplus with a wonderful governor, Mr. Walz. And one thing that really heartens me, Rick, is that we are starting in Minnesota, every 3- and 4-year-old is going to get free daycare, free preschool. And every kid, rich or poor, is going to get the free lunch. And they're not going to have different colored tickets, one for the poor kids, so they're humiliated, and one for the other kids. No, it's all going to be the same. We've got a real hunger problem in this country. We have a wealthy suburb. It's Oakdale. And before the pandemic, they saw 400 families a week. Now they're seeing 4,000.
Wow.
And this is in one of the upper crust suburbs. I'll tell you what happened last April. The COVID money ran out, and so they slashed the food support. They slashed food stamps or SNAP benefits by a third, and that really affected people. And it was kind of a dumb move because it just shoved all millions and millions of people more to the food shelves. And so it's too bad that our Republican friends are so desperate to cut food support for children, you know? We'll go along with you Democrats on some issues, but we insist that you cut that food support to those people. All they're going to do is buy cookies for their kids or some crazy thing. You know, there's still a hunger problem. My church last Sunday, the social worker at an elementary school, you know, she wanted some snack packs for some of the kids. And so we did that after church. We made up the snack packs. But you know that really irks me, Rick. That we got to have hungry people in this country, and I really don't know why.
I think George Carlin had the best line on this one. You know, he said, you know, you got the rich people who take all the money, do none of the work. The middle class pays all the taxes, does all the work, and the poor is left around to keep the middle class showing up to those crappy jobs. To me, that's probably the best explanation I've heard.
That's a good one. Well, we got to keep our chin up, and we got to keep soldiering on and be positive, and we got to keep trying. I'm kind of relieved to see that we kind of barely have a trifecta with the House and the Senate and the governorship, but things are really looking up in my state.
Yes.
And I hope it goes around the country that way, Rick.
No, look, what's going on in Minnesota, fantastic. You know, the Minnesota miracle is amazing. What's going on in Michigan, I'm thrilled with. If Democrats could just look at those two states nationally and go, this is what we're going to do for the country, I would be thrilled.
Thanks for taking my call, Rick.
Anytime, Julie. I appreciate it. Thanks. That's the reality. I mean, you look at what they're doing in Minnesota. You look at what they're doing in Michigan. Look at what Democrats are trying to push in Wisconsin, you know, restoring labor rights and getting local control back. This is Democrats finally finding a spine, and that makes me happy because for far too long they've been a little squishy. Now, look, you know, I know, well, you're beating up on Democrats again. Yeah, I beat up on Democrats more than I beat up on Republicans because truth of the matter is I don't expect Republicans to do anything positive. I don't expect anything from them. I know they hate me. I know they hate working people. Democrats should know better. That's my view. Now, it's interesting. She said, you know, they're afraid that they're going to buy cookies or something. There was some right-wing idiot who went and got food stamps and then went to like a convenience store and bought all kinds of, you know, bought like $98 worth of candy, you know, just so he could have this, you know, this viral talking point moment. And the reality is families don't do that. The studies are very clear. Nobody does that except some idiot trying to prove a point. What people do with that money is they try to feed their families. And sadly, what they end up with is feeding their families on some of the worst food possible. The stuff that's cheap and filling. And this is, for me, again, one of these moments where we should be promoting more generous food benefits. Because it's good for families, it's good for communities, it's good for the very wealthy. But we should be moving in a direction to where we ensure that at least our children don't go hungry. Don't you think? I mean, I'm curious your thoughts, because I really want someone to tell me, no, Rick, we shouldn't be feeding the children. No, we shouldn't be helping families put food on the table. No, you're just making them lazy. You're just making them dependent. I want to hear someone justify that. Maybe Alice has got a response. Alice, what's on your mind?
Well, what I wanted to say is this. The Republicans are always claiming what great, wonderful, patriotic Christians that they are, and how we're such a Christian nation, you know, and should be following that big old book of myths, also known as the Bible. But they don't want to do anything. Yeah, I mean, it's good Lord. It says right in the New Testament, Jesus is talking about feeding the poor and taking care of the widows and suffer the little children to come on to me and the whole nine yards. And the only thing we can get out of the Republicans and the evangelical bunch is, oh, no, you cannot take birth control and you cannot have an abortion. And then after that, you know, they really don't care what happens to anybody. It's pathetic.
Yeah. No, that and it's, I mean, this is shown. I mean, it's shown since they overturned Roe. It's really shown, you know, what kind of lack of moral virtue these folks really have.
Exactly. And then, you know, I'm reading in the Washington Post, where, you know, they're going on and on about, you know, the Republicans did this, and oh my goodness, Joe Biden's so bad, and, you know, just pushing the propaganda and stuff. And then, on the other hand, they're saying, oh, dear me, so many children were accidentally thrown off of their health insurance by the state. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell are you people doing? Excuse the language. What are you people doing that you can't figure out that people need health insurance? And that what really bothers me, Rick, is, and I really hate this, is they're going around saying how morally superior they are to everyone in the world. How they're so much better. And then, but the only thing that they're doing is controlling things. Oh, no, you can't do this, and you can't do this, and you can't do this. But they're not doing anything to help anyone other than themselves,
Their
religion, and the freaking millionaires and billionaires.
You are not wrong, Alice. I appreciate the thoughts. Thank you. You know, here's the thing, and this is, you know, since we brought up the pro-birth crowd, I would have respect for the anti-abortion folks. I would have respect for them if when Roe was overturned, because I was expecting this. I was, you know, there was part of me that understands that there's a wing of that movement that understands business better than anyone. They understand how to get into the, you know, the government coffers and, you know, get their snouts, you know, trough deep in it. I really thought, you know, the red states were going to start pushing for more generous social programs. You know, we want to bring children into the world, and we're going to, and I really thought that there would be, you know, some of it, you know, on that faith-based initiative model, so that you would get government money into these faith-based organizations that then they could then dole out the deserving. Because that's what this really is about. It's about the deserving and the undeserving. And I really thought that this would happen, that, you know, state houses across the country, we would start to see some kind of movement towards social programs. That hasn't happened at all. And I'm literally shocked by it, because, look, there's a lot of money to be made by administering these programs. There really would be. But they don't even have that level of value. I mean, it's quite remarkable if you stop and think about it, because I did. I thought, you know, hey, you know, we're going to set up food banks at the local church and we'll get, you know, or, you know, whatever, you know. And it didn't happen. And it's still not happening. There's no legislation in any of these red states to deal with all of the babies that they're mandating being born. So they're just making our poverty problems even worse. I know. The churches will take care of it. That's what I've heard that repeatedly. Problem is, ain't working. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. We're going to take a quick break. Right back.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that came to be known as the Invergordon Mutiny in Scotland. The global depression had begun to sweep across Europe. In response to the economic crisis, the British government began cutting the pay of public sector workers. This included those in the armed forces. This came at a time when more workers were joining the armed forces because of the rising unemployment that ravaged the private sector. For those in the Navy, the proposed pay cuts were 10% for officers and as high as 25% for those under the rank of petty officer. As news of the pay cuts spread, sailors at Invergordon held meetings to discuss their response. Invergordon, Scotland, had become an important harbor for the British fleet during World War I. The sailors decided to strike. On the day of the strike, several ships were scheduled to participate in exercises. But the sailors on four vessels refused to take their ships out of the harbor. Many men did not report for duty. Naval leaders gave in quickly, reducing the severity of the pay cuts. But many of the leaders of the strike faced reprisals. Some were jailed. Others were drummed out of the Navy. Spies for the Admiralty went below decks to monitor the sailors and report those who might cause future trouble. Government leaders tried to keep the news of the strike out of the news. But workers' rallies against public sector cuts spread to cities like Glasgow and London. The strike also caused a panic at the London Stock Exchange. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, I love the Maganomics frame that the president has been using. And look, you gotta put. I guess you give credit where credit is due. Trump and the Republicans have done a masterful job of enriching the very wealthy in corporate America. They have, and you look at the only accomplishment they got through, which was Paul Ryan's baby. It did what it was supposed to do. It created an environment where the very well-to-do did very well. Now the weird thing is, I was having this conversation with someone today, and I said, you know, you go back and you look at what the Trump tax cuts did, and it took a lot of the deductions that working people used to take, took them away. And I said, that's a negative. It's a bad thing. It's harmful to working people. And gas prices were $1 a gallon. And I'm going, no, gas prices were never $1 a gallon during the Trump years. Not even when they had nowhere to put the oil. No, that's not true. And this is the weird world that we live in, because when you try and talk to the red hats about the difference between what President Biden is actually trying to do and the direction that he is moving us as a country and what they believe, again, the believe crowd, there's almost no reality base to it. And I think, at the end of the day, as I've been saying, the sane and rational amongst us have to get out and vote. And we have to get out and vote in large numbers. We have to pull other people along with us to go vote. And maybe there will be a moment where people, come around. But I'm not hopeful. Because, look, there's still the economic folks who are looking at, the Reagan era as that was golden economic policy. The policies that got us into the mess that we're in right now. Understand, all of the deindustrialization that happened was accelerated during the Reagan years.
all the job losses that have happened over the last 40 years accelerated under the Reagan years. It was those policies, and it was the Reagan acolytes who then came after him, who said, no, we're gonna pursue all of these bad ideas for working people. Now understand, all of this stuff works exactly as it's supposed to. You know, supply side, you know, trickle down voodoo Reaganomics is not a failure for the people at the top. It works exactly as it is supposed to. It is doing exactly what it was meant to do, and that is make the rich richer and the poor poorer. Doesn't get any easier to explain than that. So when the president starts talking about Bidenomics and the idea that we're going to grow an economy from the middle out and the bottom up, that freaks out. That freaks out the very well among us, which is why we keep hearing these stories of Joe Biden's too old, because that's all they've got. You know, Joe Biden's old. Yeah, he is. He's old. And I'll be the first to say it. He's old. And he has a hard time getting sentences out. Absolutely. Yes, you won that debate. Congratulations. He's old and he struggles to speak because he's got a speech problem. Yep, 100%. But policy-wise, oh, we can't talk about that because he's old. That's how these debates go. So for me, from this moment forward, I don't want to hear about him being old. I want to hear about what policies you don't like. Because, you know, the other guy, the one on the other side, have you seen him? Have you seen the direction that he's going? He's old too, but you don't hear that very much, do you? Because you know, our media seems to be picking favorites here. Or is it just, you know, the unfavored incumbent? I'm not sure. But I'll tell you right now, Biden is doing all the things that need to be done. No matter what the Republicans throw at him, no matter what nonsense they dream up, he's doing a heck of a job. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So my email box for the last couple of days just been jammed with gun nuts losing their minds and, well, begging for dollars. Because that's what happens when they lose their minds. Whenever a Democrat does something that they think is infringing on their fetish, it's all about outrage and, oh, give us money. And look, I'm not quite sure what's going on in New Mexico, but the governor there, under their skin, got their ire and, of course, their hands out. Now, what she had proposed, I guess, has already been ruled unconstitutional. And I guess she's already amended what that was to only cover parks and playgrounds or something. But that's why I've asked my good friend Richard Eads to come share some thoughts with us. He's the afternoon show host at KTRC AM Talk 1260, AM FM 103.7. You can hear him weekdays 1 to 4 p.m. locally. Also, check out their website, santafe.com. Richard, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's a pleasure. It's finally to be on the Rick Show, Rick Smith Show, which airs on our station in the evening, so I appreciate the invitation.
No, I appreciate you coming here. So what's going on? I all of a sudden, I'm hearing your governor's name every day now. What's going on in New Mexico here?
Well, now a lot of us are wondering what's going on in New Mexico. For a long time, we've been wondering what's going on in New Mexico. This week has been fairly entertaining in terms of politics. Unfortunately, it comes on the heels of some very tragic situations where several children have died because of stray gunshots. Well, one, the latest one, an 11-year-old, unfortunately, you know, the family was leaving a minor league baseball game. Apparently some kind of altercation happened, road rage happened, a car pulled over and emptied a magazine of bullets into the car, killing the 11-year-old. So that's the latest that prompted the governor, and that came on the heels of a 6-year-old being killed by stray bullets, the governor to take action. Her action was to ban guns. He said it's just a pause under a emergency safety order, kind of the same order that we used to deal with the COVID situation, saying that, you know, guns are a public health threat, and therefore she was going to ban concealed and open carry in Albuquerque, in Bernalillo County, which is our biggest city and has been for a long, long time, Rick, very unsafe because of guns and drugs and violent crime.
Now, I'm no constitutional scholar, and I'm not a gun fetishist either, but it sounds like that would be ruled unconstitutional just on its face, which I guess has happened, right?
It did. It was a judge, after several lawsuits, a number of groups, gun groups, as well as a Republican Party filed lawsuits, and a judge ruled that he blocked her order and said we'll have a full hearing on it October the 3rd. It was only good for 30 days, as all of these emergency health orders are, good for 30 days, and they must be renewed, but it didn't get that far. So today she held a press conference with Democratic legislators and public safety officials, and she said, well, the gun pause, gun ban, however you want to, whatever you want to call it, is no longer in effect, as you just pointed out, except in playgrounds and parks where children are. Now, if there's no children present, then you can carry a gun.
Then it's the Wild West. Now there's got to be a long-term plan here, because ultimately I got to assume that's going to get shot down as well. I probably shouldn't have put it that way, but that's going to get knocked down as well. I got to think that this is going to put the ball back on the other side. So, okay, we propose this. How are you going to keep people safe? Or am I reading too much into this?
Well, there has to be a long-term plan, Rick. Unfortunately, there has not been a long-term plan, though the governor argued today that the legislature has put, over the last few years, close to $1 billion into these issues, but only about a little less than 40% of that money has actually been spent. There is no real long-term plan, and this has been something that has come about over, I would guess, about a decade, Rick, because two previous administrations, both Republican, former governor Susana Martinez and former mayor of Albuquerque, R.J. Berry, when this really started to become an issue, become an apparent issue, you know, above ground, they were very lax and very slow to recognize it or to do anything about it. Governor Martinez, the previous governor, who's a Republican, never went to Albuquerque, never spoke about this, never stood next to the mayor of Albuquerque and said, this is an issue, we need to do something about it. So I guess it just emboldened the drug dealers, and which is the real root cause of this, to grow and to get bigger and bigger, to the point where now, it used to be, Rick, well, Central Avenue is the main road that goes all the way through Albuquerque, from the west side to the east side. And it used to be where you could say close to 90% of violent crime happened within three blocks of Central Avenue. Well, now it's everywhere. Now it's into the affluent neighborhoods. Now it is everywhere in Albuquerque, where really you're not safe. And the governor mentioned that twice in a press conference and in an interview on CNN. She said, Albuquerque is not safe. You can imagine how the Chamber of Commerce, the real estate brokers react to that. And she said, New Mexico is not safe. And that's the same reaction, I would imagine, from the business community, saying, well, that's fine branding for our city and state. But now it's everywhere in Albuquerque. And now all of a sudden, you know, it's time to try this proven to be unconstitutional move, which I think was out of frustration, maybe. She got some bad advice, obviously, to try something, and it has backfired against her politically terribly. Yesterday tweeted that she's waiting a thank you note from the state Republican Party.
She should. No, I mean, because I'm in Pennsylvania, and I'm getting people emailing me, fundraising, send us money. There's a gun grabber, send us money. And I'm going, I don't think it was a great move, but you've at some point, what you've laid out, you got to try something. And, you know, as I was hearing you kind of lay out, you know, how this has grown. Look, you know, most places where you find high crime, you know, high violence rates are poverty ridden areas. But to hear it starting to spread to the suburbs, now that means, hey, we got to take some action. And is it possible that now that it's maybe getting into the more affluent areas, that maybe someone's going to start to care? Because look, I grew up in a housing project. I know nobody cares about poor people. I know when violence happens in poor neighborhoods, nobody cares. But when it gets out into the good addresses, when it gets out into the in where the money's at, then people start to listen. Do you think that's a possibility?
One would think so. One would really hope so, Rick, that the people who do the donating, the people who are important to an elected official, in fact, all elected officials, would speak out. And rather than just expressing frustration, try and find some solutions. We have the governor fairly recently appointed a crime task force headed by the district attorney in Bernalillo County. They have, to my knowledge, not offered any solutions, any way forward. A very good friend of mine, a frequent guest on my radio show, was asked to help with it. They needed somebody because of the way political task force are. They needed a fair balance of political parties, and he was a Democrat. He is a Democrat, even though former DEA agent. Of some renown, and they said, well, you're just going to have to be a consultant. You can't be a member. He laid out, he went to the district attorney's office, laid out a very coherent plan of things that he thinks maybe need to be done. And these things, you know, these ideas, which are good, which could be of value, are just shelved. Is there a long-term plan? Not that I've heard, not that I've seen, not that the governor or anybody else has laid out to the public.
So what's the first move then? I mean, look, this political stunt backfired badly. And you know, your governor's right. You know, she's filled the coffers of the gun nuts. What is the way forward? Because, you know, I hear this a lot. There's this sense of hopelessness. There's this frustration because we keep burying children who are helpless in all this, who are being murdered on our streets. What is the way forward?
Boy, Rick, I wish I had a good canned soundbite answer for that. But, you know, I'm as in the dark as I think most people, most of the professionals in this field. But it does take money. It does take coordination. Drugs are a big part of this. We're a border state. We're easy access with possibly some lax laws. Judges that have a revolving door for many of these criminals. She has laid out, the governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, has laid out that we need to fund our detention facilities, have them staffed so that the revolving door is less. We need to help people who have drug addiction problems, drug abuse problems, because that's the low-hanging fruit, to help those people deal with their situation so they're not committing crimes, which could turn violent, to feed their habit. Those are the obvious things. We need task forces. We're a very rural state with a lot of our smaller towns that are very poor, that don't have access to intelligence, to sharing data, to crime labs. We could have mobile crime labs that could go to certain areas that cannot afford a standalone crime lab or standalone adequate police force or have the knowledge around interdiction of cross-border criminals. Instead, you know, from the right, all we hear today is close the border, build a wall, and Democrats are weak and ineffective on these issues. It starts with funding. We have lots of money. We're rich with oil and gas, unfortunately, which is a whole other topic. About $3.6 billion we're looking at in new money just in 1 year from oil and gas. So there, you know, we have the cash. We have to spend it effectively and liberally, I should say, at this point, to try and attack this problem at the base.
Yeah. No, my gun nut friends say, you know, just what you said, you know, seal off the border, you know, build the wall and arm everyone, more guns. And I keep asking, like John Stewart asked, you know, when do we get to peak safety? When do we get enough guns that we're then safer?
We don't.
Oh.
We don't. We do need some better laws. We have enacted over the last few sessions of our legislature. We have a non-professional government legislature in our state. We're the last state to have volunteer legislators. We don't pay them. We have these weird 30-day sessions followed by a 60-day session. It's nonsensical. It's unprofessional. We need to change that. That's a whole other topic. We tried to do that a little bit and incrementally this year, and it failed. But that some of those are constitutional things. But we don't. We have tried to pass some and have passed some meaningful, helpful gun laws, including extreme protection laws or red flag laws, however you want to call them. Unfortunately, as in many other states, you can pass the laws, but then those who are tasked with enforcing those, namely sheriff's departments, yeah, refuse to do it because a lot of them are Republicans.
Jeez. And, you know, the problems, as you've pointed out, you know, drug addiction is something we should be dealing with, and we do a horrible job at this. Poverty, we do a horrible job at this. In fact, I'm sure you've seen the child poverty numbers that have, yep, more than doubled because of policy choices in D.C. And as I understand, New Mexico is a state that's just hammered with child poverty anyway. And it, this just seems like a piling on to me, Richard.
Well, you know, we for a brief time, unfortunately, because of a bad and tragic situation, which was a pandemic, we enacted child tax credits, which lifted many, many families out of poverty. Did we continue with something that was obviously working? No, because it was politically unpopular with one of the parties. We could have child tax credits to help families raise kids. You know, we have an abundance of issues here that are basically just a bunch of circles that are Venn diagrams, that starting with poverty, starting with adverse childhood experiences, which add up. And if those aren't treated, they become adult problems, teenage problems, and adult problems that lead to violence and incarceration and just a continued cycle. We have long-term systemic problems. Used to be heroin in northern New Mexico towns, the heroin capitals of the world. Now it's, you know, now it's opiates and fentanyl. These are a big part of the problem. The addiction is a big part of the problem. The availability and how cheap fentanyl is, and of course how lethal fentanyl is a big problem. We have to attack all of these problems, but they're all of one piece, and many of them stem from systemic endemic poverty, yep, generational problems.
That's where I say all the time, you know, a good union job solves a lot of problems. Last question I've got for you. All of my gun fetishists, they keep throwing out that they want the governor removed. We're going to throw her out. Any chance she gets ousted because of this before
Zero.
Her term is up?
Zero.
That's what
we are, you know, we're a very blue state. The legislature, both houses are very blue, almost super majorities. The Republicans can try. They would be better off to use their time, use their energy to work with the Democrats. They say, well, we're not listened to, and they were not invited to the press conference today. The governor was asked, will you call a special session around this issue? And the Speaker of the House was there, and as he reiterated as well, with 2 months before the session, it would be useless because it will be we'll get no help from the Republicans. It'll just be a partisan dogfight. Which would actually, you know, we would find no solutions, no helpful ideas. So, but no, they have no power at all to remove the governor.
Well, I hope we start moving in a direction that helps lessen some of this. And,
yeah, me both.
And move us in a better direction. But Richard, I appreciate you taking some time and filling us in and filling in some of the holes. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Been a pleasure.
Appreciate it. Richard Ease. He's the afternoon host there at KTRC in Santa Fe. Make sure you check out their website, santafe.com. He's the afternoon host at KTRC, 1260 AM, 103.7 FM. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So President Biden has a nickname for Donald Trump. And look, it's about time. Turnabout fair play. Remember that stuff? I thought it was quite humorous in a certain way. Look, I'm not a big name caller fan, but in this case, it kind of fits. as the president said in his speech, there are only two presidents in American history with fewer jobs the day they left office than when they started. One is President Hoover, and the other is Donald Hoover Trump. And I guess you have to get the reference. He's referencing that Donald Trump is like Herbert Hoover. And for those, you know, the historical memories of Hoovervilles, all the homeless people, because they lost their jobs because, well, when the Great Depression happened, it was Herbie who was on the job that day. Now, here's the thing. We went to Herbert Hoover's presidential library in West Branch, Iowa, during our Working Class Heroes tour. And it's one of the more amazing presidential libraries, in that talks about almost nothing about his presidency. There was like one wall that had, maybe like a 10 inch by 10 inch little, story about the Great Depression. That was it. Everything in the presidential library was about his work after. And he was a great humanitarian. I mean, the story of, how he fed the world and how he did all these incredible things, post presidency, pretty remarkable. And look, he had a very notable rise to the presidency. But I do find it interesting that when you went to the library, the Great Depression was like one little, just a little tiny section that you had to go look for. If you weren't looking for it, you could miss it. And I find it interesting that that the president has chosen to tie Trump up in this, and he should. Look, the reality is what it is. During Donald Trump's tenure, we lost millions of jobs. That's it. And, as he said, two presidents left office with fewer jobs than when they started. One was Hoover, the other was Donald Trump. My predecessor promised to be the greatest job president in history. Well, it didn't work out that way. He lost 2 million jobs over the course of his presidency. And he's not wrong. What has happened over the last 2 years has really been quite remarkable. And I give Biden credit for not screwing it up. I had this conversation the other day with Morris Pearl before we went on air. And he said, I think presidents get, maybe a little bit too much credit when the economy's good, or too much blame when the economy's bad. And I said, look, it's like, I believe being president with the economy is a lot like being a coach of any sport. Coaches never win. They never win the game. They lose a lot of games, but they never win a game. They never go out there and score the winning touchdown or hit the winning home run. They never do any of that stuff. But they make really bad decisions that screw things up. And I see this in that same light. You go back to the Clinton era. Clinton left Greenspan in place. Greenspan didn't slam the brakes on when the economy was heating up, let things play out. Whereas in the past, they'd have slammed on the brakes and there wouldn't have been that big good economy that George W. Bush was able to destroy. Same thing with Biden.
as the economy came swinging back, he helped where necessary. We got some investment in infrastructure, got some investment in reshoring manufacturing, you know, did a lot on shoring up our supply chain, did a bunch of that stuff to help move in the direction, keep facilitating things as it's going, and then getting out of the way. And I look at what's going on with the UAW right now in the same light. You know, he's not jumping in the middle of all that. He's keeping tabs on it, and he's getting out of the way. They're going to figure it out. They're going to hammer it out. That's what I want from someone. Don't want a micromanager. Don't want someone who's going to destroy things by tinkering too much. But I think he's doing the right things, and I think he has the right temperament. And as I said before, you know, the moneyed interests are freaking out because he wants them to pay taxes. He wants them to pay for the investments. He wants them to pay for helping the economy move in a more positive direction, you know, through higher wages. Do you think the CEOs of the big three are thrilled that Biden hasn't put the thumb on the scale like Trump did? What was the first thing Trump said? Well, the UAW leadership threw them under the bus. They sold them out. That is the corporate line. So I'll tell you, it's quite amusing. But I'm Donald Hoover Trump. tell me what you think. Is it appropriate to tie them up together? I think Hoover would be kind of upset. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So George sent me an email during the break. No justice, no Jeeps.
Kind of like that.
And look, you know, I saw Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown at the picket line in Toledo today in his Jeep saying, look, him and his wife, that's what they drive. They drive Jeeps and they want to continue. And same thing. I got a Jeep Wrangler. I love my Jeep Wrangler. I do. But if Stellantis were to move to Mexico, it would be the last, Chrysler Jeep. My wife's got a Charger. It would be the last product we bought of theirs. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, the strike being front and foremost. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
So you got about, 13,000 workers out on the picket lines right now, representing the 150,000 UAW members overall. Any thoughts on the day's events?
Sure, a lot of thoughts. First of all, as we know, there's a strike at three locations. But one thing that I think is within the union's favor is the fact that they can then pick other sites if they so choose, and they can do it strategically. Because this is unprecedented. They went after all three at the same time. And so they can pick certain sites. We all know what a supply chain is now these days.
Yep.
And so that gives them, I think, an advantage, a working advantage over the company. I Googled this, and I have to admit, Rick, I was beyond shock. I have not kept up with, what the auto workers make. And so I Googled it.
Yep.
Top tier workers, meaning anyone who joined the company in 2007 or earlier, make roughly $33 an hour on average. Contract summaries for the big three show. Those hired after 2007 are part of the lower tier and earn up to $17 an hour based on a buildup of 6% annual raises. I pay people, in my flips, $16 an hour to cut grass, yeah. Okay? I was astounded. These wages, I think people thought, oh, the auto workers, they make pretty big money. Well, the big money is being made by the big corporate giant leaders in their parachutes and, everything else golden. I was just amazed. Talk about somebody needing a raise.
No, and this is, you know, this is where I think Sean Fain's got it right. You know, he said, look, this is this generation's moment. The cause mm-hmm. is righteous. This is their time. Because, yeah. look, you know, we all thought, you know, these are the gold standard jobs. These are the blue collar. These are the pinnacle of the blue collar workforce. And as you've pointed out, $17 an hour, that ain't the pinnacle anymore.
No, you can go to almost any fast food place. In California, they just have a standard now, I think, sort of like a minimum wage for fast food. I think they might have some unionization, I'm not sure, but they announced it on TV in California. It's $20 an hour.
Yeah.
And so the fast food worker is making what somebody, you know, who joined after 2007 is making as an auto worker. And, you know, I'm not begrudging anybody a wage anywhere, but when you start to look at this, wow, president of the union makes not a great point. He makes a fantastic point about if anybody ever deserved this, they do.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. You know, you're a little bit older than I am, but I still remember when these jobs were the driver of a prosperous working
yes.
class. This is what, you know, everyone aspired to be. This is where, you know, that rising tide lifting all boats thing. This was the driver of the rising tide. And now what it's been over the last several years is it's been the anchor that's been pulling us down. And I think what Sean Fain's saying is, look, we've got to turn this around. And I think this is an important moment, not just for the workers who are going to get, you know, hopefully a better deal, but for everybody who works, in that we turn this tide of, you know, well, you know, stagnant and declining wages.
Right. And if you look at the average steel worker in California, it's $19.84 an hour. Yeah, and it used to be, I mean, these were the jobs, you're right, auto workers. I mean, they were the jobs that people strive to get. I remember telling my father, I said, I am not going to college. I'm going to be a steel worker. I'm going to be a coal miner, you know, because my friends were doing that,
yeah.
making a decent wage, you know, start families. And, you know, that was the thought. And then if you could ever become an auto worker, wow, you know, they were jobs that, you know, fed people. They were jobs that helped the community.
Yeah.
And when you look at this, I mean, that in itself, if people only knew, you know, what the wages are, it's disgraceful.
No, look, I tell the story all the time. You know, this is, you know, mid-70s. But, you know, I remember the neighbor, you know, in the housing project that I lived in. I remember the guy got a job at Ford. It was a UAW job. And immediately, within days, you saw their lives get better. Food at the end of the month.
Sure.
You know, bikes for the kids, better clothes, you know, mm-hmm. a secondhand car. Eventually moved out altogether. Immediately, their lives got better on that one job.
Right.
And for me, you know, as a kid looking at it going, you know, union job, better life. How can you disagree with that? And I think that's part of what they're fighting for. And I hope they get everything that they earn.
Right. And of course, you know, there's been record profits. So how can you have a stagnant pay level with record profits?
Yeah.
It just doesn't go hand in hand. It's time has come.
It's time has come. I got to get your thoughts on this. I got to change topics here because
sure.
Evidently, is there anyone Corey Lewandowski isn't having relations with? Have you seen this story coming out of South Dakota?
Yeah. Yes, of course. I saw the story. I don't know. I don't know anything about it, and I haven't talked to him in ages. So I don't know. But yes, I obviously read the story. Friends of mine sent it to me today. And, you know, friends of his, friends of mine. And so I read through it.
Yeah, I was telling somebody, I go, you know, because the reason I bring it up is I think he was, you know, he kind of started around you, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. I always make, you know, disclosures, which I did on your show a long time ago in 2016 and all the shows, when he became campaign manager for Trump, before Trump got rid of him, and then Paul Manafort came in, and Paul liked to meet with those Russians, you know, and the rest is history. But yes, Corey Lewandowski, I hired him to run my campaign twice. So for a 4-year period, he ran my campaign. And I must say, you know, I had hired a couple of people. We darn near got taken out in 1996. And we had to revive our system. And, yes, we hired Corey Lewandowski. And then later on, he went to work for, I think, Bob Smith for Senate campaign, and then a couple other groups, and then lobbied for the seafood industry, and then somehow got with Trump.
And now somehow he's hooking up with the governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem. And look, I generally don't care about any of this stuff, honestly. Uh-huh. None of my business for the most part. Uh-huh. But when you're putting yourself out as, you know, the example of clean, good, God-fearing living, and, you know, this kind of morality that you know, hey, you should follow me, this kind of stuff then catches my attention. This right. is the kind of stuff where you go, you're a hypocrite much? No, just a lot.
Right. Yeah, I gotcha. But yes, when he worked for us, he didn't, there was no articles on any governors.
Also, got to get your thoughts on President Biden said he's not going to pardon his son if Hunter is convicted. Are you surprised by that?
No, I thought he would make that statement. Look, if this whole, I read through these articles three times today, and we could do an entire show on this thing. They did a plea deal. At the time I said, because there's always politics in these things in the sense that he did a plea deal. It was 2023. They got it out of the way. The world was happy politically, okay, on the Biden campaign. Then they go into the courtroom, and it's like somebody lobbed a grenade to the front of the judge's bench, right?
Yeah.
And the whole deal explodes. Now, what I expected after that was for Biden's lawyers to immediately get with the Justice Department and say, okay, hey, you know, where do we go from here? Instead, it kind of sat there, and now one of the lawyers for Hunter Biden is saying, well, Justice Department, this is ramped up because of the Republicans, you know, et cetera. Of course, Justice is going after, you know, Trump. So I'm sitting here looking at this, and I just think in my mind, Rick, that this was just legally between Justice and the lawyers. Just, you know, somebody didn't dot an I or cross a T. And I don't know if I was advising Hunter Biden, not the Biden campaign, because they don't decide this. If I was advising Hunter Biden, I would, you know, lawyers need to get with the Justice Department, sit down and see where the flaws were on the original deal.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting simple. To me is, you know, this is a gun charge. Where are the this first one? This is a gun charge. Where are the gun nuts? Because, you know, Hunter Biden's lawyer is saying, look, this is unconstitutional. He expects it to get tossed before it goes to trial. But where are the gun fetishists? Where are all the right, you know, saying, you know, yeah, this is wrong. We shouldn't be doing this to gun people.
Well, if it was Donald Trump Jr., you'd hear him. They'd be emailing you.
Yeah. Or if you look, you know, Kid Rock is a guy who's claimed he's used every substance and blowing up Bud Light, you know, cases with an AR-15. Could we not say, hey, you know, same thing for him?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think too, looking at the legal argument, because this is being disputed, but the legal argument is at an appellate court level. Look, I went to prison, and I came out of prison in 2008. In 2010, 6-0, the charge that was used against me on a services fraud was found unconstitutional, 6-0. You know, now we kind of knew if we could hold out, that charge might drop. Now, had I held out, and probably wouldn't even be alive if I had.
They'd hit you with 100 other things.
Yeah, or mentally alive. But if I had held out until 2010, my charge would have, you know, would have went away. So looking at this, you know, from the theory that, well, this charge, I don't think that's going to hold. It'll go on, you know, too long. But you're right. There are people that do like the fact that the appellate court is looking at this very charge. There are people that like guns that are doing that, but they're not going to be vocal. You know how it runs with Hunter Biden.
I got to tell you, man, the more I talk to you, the more if I'm you, I'm bitter. I mean, because what you got sent to jail for, it was over. It's not even a crime anymore.
Well, that's true. Well, I went into recovery, so you deal with these issues. Plus, you have life, and, you know, I get to do your show. Hey, come on, you know, life's okay.
Yeah.
But the one thing that did get me, I'm going to tell you right now, because in prison, people are going like, hey, what do you think about Scooter Libby? The one point that got me was when President Bush said, well, Scooter's paid enough of a price. Excuse me. Did he lose his house and car? I didn't think so. Yeah, that one got me a little bit. Well, Scooter's paid enough of a price. We're not going to put him behind bars.
Wow.
You know,
yeah,
that one kind of got me a little bit.
I hear that. Now, you talk about your recovery quite often, and I think it's important, especially in talking about Hunter Biden, because, you know, what I've been saying here recently is, you know, you look at what the Republicans are doing to Joe Biden over, you know, making phone calls every day to Hunter Biden and all of this. And I said, look, this is just a father, you know, giving a rat's behind about his kid being a good parent. I'm curious your thoughts of, you know, you look at Hunter and the problems that he's had, especially, you know, trying to get through recovery. Do you see anything here that sends red flags for you?
Yes, a couple of things. One, I think we have to understand, yes, and Hunter Biden did wrong. Fine. Let's throw that on the table. He did wrong, all right? But we also have to realize that Hunter Biden was an addict and is an addict and will be an addict because you're always in recovery if you're not alcoholic or addict, always. You know, it doesn't end. And he could have made decisions that his father was not drug into, his father was not part of, his father was not wrapped into. You know, to have his father call and he put him on speakerphone or something of that nature, that doesn't mean that Joe Biden called and said, hey, why don't you do this or do that or tell your associates, you know, you're my son. But if Hunter Biden was in active addiction, there were decisions that Hunter Biden could have made that would be flawed. That would be, you know, I call it when you're in your fogged state, right?
Right.
That doesn't mean that Biden, as a dad, was doing something to, you know, further him, but as a dad was communicating with him. This is torturous for families. I don't care if you're Vice President of the United States, President of the United States, you know, or you're the local guy down the street and woman. This is torturous for them. So, yes, the constant calls by Joe Biden to his son, that's not strange.
No,
that's not a strange thing. They had to be distraught. They had to be worried.
Yeah, in fact, that's what you're supposed to do, isn't it? I mean, this is what a good parent does.
Right.
And, you know, someone, you know, emailed me and said, well, you know, he has all these alias email addresses. And I go, well, yeah, I've got a couple of email addresses that I use that aren't show related. I've got one for, you know, for personal things. I've got one for other business things. I've got a whole bunch of these things that you use for different purposes that, you know, maybe you don't want everyone having access to. Maybe you do have a direct line to your son so that there's direct communication. You know, maybe there's other reasons other than the stuff that they're trying to claim were for nefarious purposes.
It's not unusual. Members of Congress have unlisted numbers on their desk, used for family, maybe some for contributors, but used for family and friends and things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that part didn't grab me as unusual at all. And the fact that, you know, Biden called him, or the fact that he put, at that time, Vice President Biden on a speakerphone, again, because his judgment, Hunter Biden's judgment, could have been flogged, you know, fogged up, flawed, whatever you want to call it, that doesn't mean that he plotted with his father. And I'm not trying to excuse him from anything he did that was different or off color at all. Well, I don't excuse myself. But when you're in active addiction, your thinking process doesn't necessarily run correctly. That doesn't mean that your mom and dad are part of a flawed thinking process, whether your mom and dad, you know, are vice president or, like I said, workers down the street.
And now because he was a good dad and is still standing by his son, we now have an impeachment inquiry.
Right. Well, the impeachment inquiry, there's internal problems because Comer has went on. He's the congressman with the oversight committee. He's went on and he has made statements that just haven't been true. He's done that. He's tainted it. They're worried internally about him. So he's going to be the front guy for a little bit, kind of contained, keeping not on the air all the time. Then it's going to pass they're going to pass the baton to Jim Jordan of Ohio, who will, you know, try to take this inward. Now, trust me, there are a lot of Republicans that do not want this to happen because at this point in time, if you think the president's done something wrong. You gather information. You can have hearings. You can have oversight hearings. Doesn't mean you have to have impeachment oversight hearings.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be entertaining.
Well, it will also take, depends on how they handle, because here's what I told somebody today. The problem with the Congress is how they handle it. They came up with a great idea to do these budgets, and now they're not doing them. They came up with some, you know, good ideas with some new rules, and now they don't implement them. And now they've come up with this idea, and, you know, they could completely mess this up and turn this on themselves.
And that's what I'm hoping.
Which is probably what's going to happen.
You know, they need something to do because they're not doing their job. So this might as well be it.
Right.
Fun and entertaining times. But Bob, as always, I appreciate the thoughts, the time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Bob Ney. They're not doing anything else. They don't have any other plans. They haven't any policy aims. So, you know, why not a little bread and circus? It just is what it is. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1845. 5,000 female workers at the Allegheny Cotton Mill went on strike for a 10-hour workday. The fast streams around Pittsburgh and Allegheny City were ideal to power cotton mills. The mills were overheated and filled with dangerous dust. Many of these women and child workers suffered from work-related lung diseases. The 7 factories of Allegheny City employed about 1,500 young women. These women earned between $2.50 and $6 a week. They worked from sunrise to sunset, 6 days a week. Children made $3 a week at most. In 1843, factory owners cut wages even further. In the 1940s, a woman who had worked in the mills noted, "The ear filled with the noise of thousands of spindles." Anger over the deplorable working conditions grew. In early 1845, the women and children had had enough. They walked off the job and demanded a 10-hour workday and a living wage. Men supported them by gathering to protect the women from police attacks. After holding out for a month, the women began to return to work to survive. Some of the remaining strikers decided to try and remove the returning workers from the mills. They armed themselves with axes, but could not dislodge the workers. Public opinion turned against the striking women. Then, in September, workers marched on one of the largest area mills. The women broke down the factory gates and forcibly evicted the scab workers. The strike lasted for 6 months, but slowly, out of desperation, more and more of the women workers went back to the mills. Although the women did not get their demands, the strike drew national attention. On Independence Day in 1848, the Pennsylvania legislature put into effect a 10-hour day law. But sadly, the law had numerous loopholes and had no real enforcement. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. So we're heading towards a government shutdown, right? That's coming. We still don't have that squared away. You've got House Republicans. I'm not even sure. Are we doing impeachment or are we just pretending? We've got one guy in the Senate who's blocking all the military promotions, and there's no end in sight there. You've got Lauren Boebert, blowing smoke in or vape fumes in a pregnant woman's face and getting thrown out of Beetlejuice. You've got a Republican Party in shambles, and they're holding the country hostage. This is one of these moments where you go, folks, there's a problem. There's a problem, and we can solve this problem. You throw the bums out. You get rid of these people because they don't have any idea of how to govern. They won a popularity contest because, people were angry, and they were the angry choice. And they told everyone, we're gonna stop bad things, only to do nothing but bad things. I mean, can you look at the House and say that there's a functional, that it's a functional body? It is in chaos. Congress is in crisis. The country is in crisis because of a clear and present danger, and that is the current Republican Party. I mean, I hate saying that. I wish we had a functional two-party system that got things done. I wish there were ways to negotiate and you know, because we got problems. I was thinking about this earlier. You know, 20 years ago, you probably could have gotten people to say, you know what, maybe we have the ability to get some funding to not let child poverty double. Maybe there would have been a couple of Republicans that would have come along. Maybe. Or am I looking to the past and hoping I'm right? Or were they just as bad back then? I don't know, but here's the reality. We have an opportunity. This coming year, 2024, we have an opportunity to elect a Democratic House and Senate, keep Joe Biden in the White House, and start moving on some more policy to move us in the right direction. Because I think from what I see, what I've been advocating for all the 18 years I've been doing this show, Biden is moving in those directions. And that is a good thing. Undoing some of the neoliberal DLC Democratic strongholds, getting rid of some of that stuff, getting rid of, you know, the economic policies that have put working people in such a bind. Good stuff. We just need a functional legislative branch. And we don't have it right now. Not even close. If you miss any of today's program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, you got something on your mind, something I said got on your nerves, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. We will hash it out. I do answer all emails personally. Appreciate you tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.